Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You know, it's a serious meeting at the White House when they don't let any cameras in. What CEOs told the president behind those closed doors today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the all-new Chevrolet Volt, available soon in select markets. Details at ChevyVolt.com. The all-new Chevrolet Volt. It's more car than electric. And by Novo Nordisk, since 1923, innovative developer of diabetes treatments and delivery devices at NovoNordisk-US.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Wednesday, today the 15th of December. Good, as always, to have you here. I'm going to take an educated guess for a second and say that for 5 hours today, President Obama was probably the worst paid guy in the room. He invited 20 CEOs over for lunch and a discussion of what private industry can do to help get the economy going again. With the Fed and the $600 billion it's putting into the economy and the $800 billion stimulus, give or take, from the tax cut deal, the president was looking for ideas from business leaders about how to seize what he calls the promise of this economic moment. Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports.
As he walked back to the White House after today's meeting, President Obama said he's optimistic businesses are ready to start spending some of their reserves.
By working together, we can get some of that cash off the sidelines.
Businesses are hoarding a record $2 trillion in profits. And to help pry some of that cash loose, the tax deal in Congress would let companies write off all the investments they make next year in new plant and equipment. Economic forecaster Richard DeKayser at Woodley Park Research says with demand looking up, businesses are ready to spend.
For example, if a corporation were to make large outlays for transportation equipment or information technology in 2011, which they now will have every incentive to do, the increased economic activity in those industries will create more jobs, more incomes, which will help stimulate economic activity more generally.
But some wonder if there are enough incentives. Matthew Slaughter is a former economic advisor to President George W. Bush. He says businesses are anxious about what happens after the equipment tax breaks phase out at the end of 2012.
That won't permanently magically increase capital investment by companies, in part because it's temporary, but also in the out years, companies, what they give up are the tax loss write-offs that they would have had in later years.
Slaughter says businesses are looking for more permanent job-creating incentives, like overall tax reform that lowers rates and allows corporations to bring home profits earned overseas tax-free. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Here's another educated guess as we move on. We are all probably more familiar with the Commerce Clause of the Constitution now than we were earlier this week. A federal judge ruled on Monday that the government can't use the powers in that clause to force people to buy health insurance. Supreme Court is probably going to have to decide, but a lot of people have started looking at that part of the healthcare law, known as the individual mandate, more closely. We asked Gregory Warner at the health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia whether there might be an alternative to it.
First, I called Randall Boberg. He's a senior fellow at the Urban Institute. He told me this.
The mandate is a very important but not totally essential part of this approach to get everybody to buy coverage. It's the stick. There is a carrot.
The carrot is the part of the reform law that makes insurance more affordable, the subsidies and regulations. To stay with that analogy, just a moment, some of those now praising the federal judge for striking down that individual mandate say, we need more carrots. Jamie Cord is author of The Progressive's Guide for Raising Hell.
So the key to getting people in the healthcare system doesn't have to do with the stick of a tax penalty. It has to do with the carrot.
Make insurance affordable enough and people will buy it.
If the carrot is beautifully wrapped and very expensive, of course.
Stuart Altman, professor of health economics at Brandeis University, says the country can't afford that carrot. He says barring some more draconian way of lowering health costs, the only alternative to the individual mandate is another stick, like making insurance more expensive each year you don't buy it. Ron Pollack is with Families USA.
You might call it an incentive or you could call it a stick, but it would make people think twice not to purchase insurance.
Pollack says that would be a punier stick than the individual mandate. There's a big stick, of course, that no one talks about. except for Randall Boberg, who got me started on this whole carrot and sticks analogy in the first place.
And that is that if you truly want to opt out of insurance, you have to opt out for good. No fair opting out now, and then if you're hit by a truck, opting in.
In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
This is the time of year when people start looking ahead to try to get some feeling for what the future might bring. Take, just for instance, the office, a place a lot of us spend a lot of time. It's been changing quite a bit as businesses try to save space and so save some money, too. Today, the Los Angeles Times observed that the cubicle is shrinking. So we sent reporter and cubicle veteran Stacey Vanek Smith to explore the cubicle of the future.
Full disclosure, I love my cubicle. But evidently, this makes me a workplace throwback. Tom Pellucci is director of interior design for architecture firm HOK.
The Dilbert cartoon where everyone's working in a cubicle farm, and you know, that's really disappeared.
Pellucci says cubicles are shrinking. Most now are 6 feet by 6 feet. Part of it's money. Office space is a company's biggest expense after salaries. But it's also just the way we work now.
Workplace has become much more collaborative. You might be sitting in a smaller personal space, or what I like to call a me space, because you're tending to end up working more in environments that are shared with your colleagues. And I like to refer to those spaces as we spaces.
One workspace with a lot of we space is social marketing firm Mr. Youth and CrowdTap. Most people work at tables or have their desks in clusters. Company CFO Dan LaFontaine says it's fun and practical.
It's incredibly efficient. Rather than have some kind of formal meeting, it's very easy just to grab a couple of people, you know, stand around one area very quickly and get done what you need to get done.
LaFontaine's workers are young, average age about 26. He says they don't really want the privacy of an office or a cubicle.
I mean, they're putting their whole lives up on Facebook and on Twitter and everywhere else anyway. There's no real reason they should hide behind a cubicle wall.
Still, LaFontaine says the office of the future does have some drawbacks.
Sometimes it gets a little bit noisy, and there are those days when you want to walk in and just have peace and quiet and get things done.
Did a microwave just go off?
That was a microwave. I believe that's popcorn you smell.
In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, down slightly. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's been an interesting development in the foreclosure paperwork story. Tom Miller, the Iowa Attorney General who's been leading the charge against big banks and their robo-signers, said he is set to launch a criminal investigation. "We will put people in jail," was the direct quote. In the meantime, the latest foreclosure numbers are going to come out tomorrow from a company called Realty Track. There will be headlines about how many more homes might wind up being bank-owned. Lots of discussion about what that might mean for the economy. But foreclosures aren't really all that easy to get a handle on. Marketplace's Lisa Roth has more.
When the numbers come out tomorrow, we'll find out how many hundreds of thousands of homes got foreclosure notices in November and how that compares to other months and years. The question is how accurate those figures are. Depending on the source, anywhere from 5 to 8 million properties are in some stage of foreclosure. Even if everybody agreed on the number, it's hard to interpret exactly how dire the situation really is. For starters, foreclosure isn't an event. It's a process. Alan White is a law professor at Valparaiso University.
Foreclosures take a while. You have states where the whole process is over and done with in a month and a half, and other states where it takes a year and a half.
The robo-signing mess means banks have frozen some foreclosures. And White says even before that, some banks were holding off on foreclosures, all of which means that many distressed properties haven't been counted yet. But there's another more basic problem. Unlike, say, unemployment or gross domestic product, there's no official foreclosure figure. The Mortgage Bankers Association keeps some stats. So do government housing agencies, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. But probably the one we hear most from is an outfit called Realty Track. Realty Track is mainly a website that lists foreclosed properties for sale, but it also releases data that includes everything from the first warning a homeowner is behind on payments to the notice the bank has repossessed the property, which is sometimes called an REO. Rick Sharga is a vice president at Realty Track.
So in the Realty Track database, we have the initial notices of default, the notices of sale,
and the REOs. We collect those largely manually in county recorder's offices, county courthouses, tax assessor's offices in 2,200 counties across the country.
Sharga says RealtyTrack has the most up-to-date statistics around. But the company's also been called out for overstating the foreclosure problem. Because it reports each step in the foreclosure process, RealtyTrack may overcount some homes in the short term. On a single house, the notice of default could get counted in October, the notice of sale in November, and the actual bank repossession in December. And each of those would appear on the corresponding monthly report. Sharga says RealtyTrack has improved its analysis, so it strips out double or triple counts on the same property.
So that over a set period of time, we only count the property once, no matter how many times it gets a foreclosure record or a foreclosure notice.
But there's still a time lag. So most of the duplication doesn't get fixed until RealtyTrack's quarterly reports, which don't get nearly as much attention in the press as the monthly reports do. Andrew McCulloch is an analyst at Green Street Advisors. It's a company that provides real estate research to investors. He says he uses data from RealtyTrack, plus numbers from the Mortgage Bankers Association, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and other places, too.
We don't take any one of these single sources as gospel.
Instead,
what we try to do is combine and interpret what they're all saying at any given time or over a certain time period.
Something to think about when you hear those foreclosure numbers tomorrow. I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
The Senate said yes to the tax cut deal today, the one that extends the Bush tax cuts and unemployment benefits as well. President Obama wants the House to pass the thing and get it to his desk pronto. Commentator Robert Reich says, not so fast.
Rarely in American history has the disconnect been bigger between what Washington is doing and what average Americans are worried about. Washington is on the verge of extending the Bush tax cuts and reducing the estate tax, both big windfalls for the wealthy. But most Americans are worried sick about their jobs and wages, and these measures won't help. The rich spend a smaller proportion of their incomes than everyone else. That's what it means to be rich. You already have most of what you want. The White House points to some middle-class tax benefits also in its pending deal with the Republicans, but they're peanuts relative to the scale of the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression. Yes, corporate profits are up, and Wall Street is back to the days of big bonuses, but nothing is trickling down. If job growth continues at October's snail's pace, employment won't be back to pre-recession levels for another 20 years. Meanwhile, the value of most Americans' major asset, their homes, continues to drop. This economy won't rebound until average Americans are doing better. We need a new WPA to put the unemployed back to work and an infrastructure bank to create jobs repairing the nation's crumbling roads, bridges, and water and sewer systems. Exempt the first $20,000 of income from payroll taxes and apply payroll taxes to incomes more than $250,000. Extend the earned income tax credit, wage subsidy, all the way up through the middle class. Pay for this by raising marginal income taxes on millionaires. Under President Dwight Eisenhower, the top marginal rate was 91%. Now, I'm not advocating this, but a millionaire marginal tax of even 70% would also go a long way toward reducing the nation's future budget deficit. But we're heading in the opposite direction. At a time when the nation's job emergency cries out for bold solutions, Washington is giving us a variation on the same failed trickle-down economics we've had for three decades.
Robert Reich was Secretary of Labor for President Clinton. His most recent book is called Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future. Next week, it's David Frum's turn. Your turn to talk back is anytime you want to. Go to marketplace.org and click on the link that says contact. Coming up, if the European Union doesn't want them, Turkey is perfectly happy to go elsewhere.
Having good relations with our neighbors really helped us a lot to improve our economy.
But first, let's do the numbers. Europe's debt crisis trumped good U.S. manufacturing news today. The Dow Industrial shed 19 points, more than a 10%, closed at 11,457. The Nasdaq surrendered 10 points, about 0.4%, finished at 2617. The S&P 500 fell 6 points, about 0.5%, ended things at 1235. Novartis bucked the downdraft, though. U.S. shares of the Swiss pharmaceutical company climbed 5.2% on news that it's going to buy the rest of the eye care company, Alcon. Alcon gained 1%. The day's stoutest performer, the Boston Beer Company, poured on 12% today thanks to a robust outlook for this year and next. We learned this week that Delta Airlines has made billions on luggage and other fees, but today its stock descended 3.25%. That after the company predicted slimmer profit margins. Bond prices continued their slide. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.53%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. And by Microsoft, providing comprehensive business solutions for the cloud. You can learn more at Microsoft.com/cloud. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet. What does Tier 1 Capital have in common with a wedding cake? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on new home construction for the month of November. Representatives from the 565 federally recognized tribes are expected in the Capitol for the White House Tribal Nations Conference hosted by President Obama. And WikiLeaks is the topic at a House Judiciary Committee hearing. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
It's Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. If I say saccharin this time of year, you probably think I'm talking about something like this.
Chestnuts roasting on an open fire.
That would be saccharin as an adjective, artificially sweet or sugary. We are really talking here, though, about saccharin the noun, the artificial sweetener that got a bad rap back in the 1970s when it was thought to cause cancer. 10 years ago, the Food and Drug Administration said, actually, saccharin is safe. The warning labels came off the packages. But until yesterday, saccharin was still on the EPA's list of hazardous materials. Marketplace's Eve Troe reports now on the business of the sweet stuff.
A group called the Calorie Control Council represents diet foods and beverages. It lobbied the EPA to take saccharin off its hazardous list. President Lynn Nabors says the label meant extra headaches for companies who worked with saccharin, but really, removal from the list was about perception.
We wanted to have a clean slate, so to speak, for saccharin. I think we now have that.
She says the food, beverage, and pharmaceutical industries love saccharin. It's cheap, and products made with it have a long shelf life. But its public image has always been lousy.
It's a derivative of coal tar, and people just thought that can't be good for you.
Rich Cohen wrote A History of Sweet and Low, the most popular form of saccharin, and his family's company. He says for decades, Sweet and Low was the only low-calorie sweetener on the market. People wondered about it, but they didn't have any other choice. Now, a clean reputation isn't enough, because consumers see new sweeteners like Splenda and Stevia as just better.
Saccharin tastes terrible, and there's always a place for it sort of at the bottom of the market, but it's sort of been passed by.
Food and beverage analyst David Brown agrees, particularly for Gen X consumers and younger, who have a lingering aftertaste that saccharin is bad, no matter the science.
They'd rather stay away from something that is questionable because it's relatively easy to do so, especially.
But he says there's no question companies will keep sneaking cheap saccharin into products where they can, from toothpaste to cough syrup. In Los Angeles, I'm Eve Troe for Marketplace.
It's Wednesday, long about mid-show. That means it's your turn.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter.
We spent some time last week talking about philanthropy. Commentator Jonah Lehrer explained the psychology of charitable giving to us, that we're more likely to donate money to feed a specific child than we are to donate to the more abstract goal of ending global hunger. His point being that our brains just can't process suffering on that level. Christopher Stack from Los Angeles disagreed.
I don't think we don't give or turn off because our emotions can't comprehend it. I think we all really comprehend that suffering, even on a big scale. I think we all really feel for it. I think our brains kick in and realize this isn't a problem we can solve.
We looked at something called prize philanthropy, too, when a company like Pepsi or American Express runs a contest where nonprofits can win money for their cause. Molly Luna of Mount Lake Terrace, Washington, is with a group called Refresh Our Playgrounds.
We and eight other partner groups are just trying to build playgrounds, and it's terribly hard and expensive to do so. Maybe we have to work very hard to get these dollars, and we give free advertising to Pepsi, but it's the world we're in at the moment.
The academic sabbatical is under fire in Iowa. Lawmakers there are trying to save some money. After hearing our story about it, Michael Harris wrote from Fairbanks, Alaska, and his post at the University of Alaska Fairbanks to challenge the notion of professors getting summers off. Academics are on 9-month contracts, Professor Harris writes. This is not actually time off, he says, but rather annual uncompensated unemployment with the obligation to return to their faculty positions in the following term. Finally, in response to our story Monday, setting up President Obama's meeting with CEOs today, William Grother of Robbinsville, New Jersey, offered this.
Business should be subservient to government, not the other way around. I think the Obama administration would do well to keep business at arm's length and do as much as possible to rein in the excesses before the next crisis develops.
Send us your thoughts about our track record, horrible or otherwise. Go to our website, is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. We're going to talk about emerging economies here for a bit, up-and-comers on the global economic stage. There are the BRIC countries, of course, Brazil, Russia, India, and China. But let's add another one to that list, Turkey. It's expected to be the world's 10th largest economy by the year 2050. Yesterday, Marketplace's Stephen Beard explained some of the problems that Turkey is having getting into the European Union. Today, where the Turkish economy is turning instead.
A truck depot in northwest Turkey, just 30 miles to the west, is the frontier with the European Union. But the depot does more and more business in the east with Lebanon, Jordan, Syria and Iran.
I believe it's Middle East much, much better opportunity at the moment.
Depot boss Hassan Bekimci says he's shipping more goods like car parts, building materials and clothes to the Middle East now that many eastern countries have lifted travel restrictions.
And now if you want to, let's say, go to Lebanon, you don't need a visa. If you want to go to Jordan, you don't need a visa. It makes everything easier and we find it more attractive in the Middle East.
Visa-free travel is one result of the Turkish government's policy of improving relations in its own backyard. As Europe, Turkey's largest export market, has suffered a downturn, Turkey has sought new customers for its goods. Ruling party lawmaker Özlem Türkeney.
Having good relations with our neighbors really helped us a lot to improve our economy. Economic aspect is very important in this process.
Turkey's exports to the Middle East doubled over the last decade. It now sells more goods to Syria and Iran than to the US. And the greater friendliness towards eastern countries such as Syria and Iran is also due to a certain frostiness from the West. There was jubilation on the streets of Istanbul 5 years ago when Turkey began EU membership talks. Today, the talks have stalled. France and Germany have made it clear that a large Muslim nation like Turkey isn't welcome. The mood on Turkey's streets today, disillusion.
We feel rejected, and I just am not happy with that.
You must be in a group. If European countries doesn't accept us,
We must be in a group.
And even if that group includes Iran and Syria, you'd be happy?
We will not be happy, but we must be in a group.
Turkey's cozying up to Iran infuriated the US, but the Turks say the West benefits from a Turkey at peace with its neighbours, and Europe would lose out by not making Turkey an EU member. Its economy is growing at around 6% a year. It has a large and youthful population and carries vast quantities of oil and gas across its territory. Arif Molu, boss of a big textile group, says Turkey is a vital friend for Europe.
We are a giant pipeline, not only for energy, for human resources, for trade, for everything. It's like a bridge for accessing the Middle East.
Building bridges between the cultures was the optimistic slogan used at the start of this year to launch Istanbul as the European capital of culture. Turkey's long struggle to join the EU has brought big rewards. To make itself eligible, the country's been forced to improve its human rights and modernize its economy. Commentator Chingiz Aktar.
Turkey still needs the Western European anchor to perform well and to continue the reformist path.
Turkey's dilemma is this. As it draws closer to countries like Syria and Iran, it risks growing further from the West and making EU membership even less likely. In Istanbul, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, www.batteninstitute.org. By Novo Nordisk, since 1923, innovative developer of diabetes treatments and delivery devices, at novonordisk-us.com. And by Putnam Investments, focused on finding opportunities one stock at a time, on the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today about the trade deficit. No, the numbers did not come out this morning. That was a couple of weeks ago. But I saw an item in the Wall Street Journal today that is too good not to pass on to you. You know how people are always saying this country needs to invent more high-tech gizmos that other countries are going to want to buy and how that's going to help us grow our economy? Yeah, that might not work out so well. A pair of researchers in Japan have run the numbers, and they say the iPhone adds almost $2 billion a year to the U.S. trade deficit with China. Yes, it's an American product, but it's made, it's put together over there. And the way the figures are kept, that's a $2 billion hit on the American account. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Wednesday. Today, the Dow shed 19 points, more than a 10th percent. The NASDAQ off 10 points, about 4/10 percent. The S&P 500 fell 6 points, a half percent. Bahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the program for us. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest and earliest in business and economic news. Coming up next time on this broadcast, hey, listen, work smarter, not harder, will you?
It was management speak that didn't sound prissy. It was really hard-nosed smart stuff.
I'm Kai Rizdal. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.